So when I was in elementary and middle school, my father used to give me the same recommendation every year. He used to say, Amara, try to find the best student in your class and sit close to him. And in my life, I tried to follow this recommendation. And actually, I was really impressed when I saw the list of the previous messenger lectures. So we have Bronislaw Malinowski in 1932. We have Noam Chomsky in 1976. We have Jürgen Habermas, one of the most important philosophers in the world, in 1984. And we have Edward Said in 1986. And in 2003, the messenger lecturer was Fukuyama. And Fukuyama, you know, the author of the book, The End of History, he was very famous in Algeria and in Arab world. So the end of the history. So my father certainly is proud of me because I am sitting with this wonderful and important people. Almost 1 year ago, so for this reason, it's a great pleasure and honor to participate in the messenger lectures. So almost 1 year ago, I came here for the first time to give a talk about immigration and to meet with readers of my novel, Clash of Civilizations, Over an Elevator in Piazza Vittorio. It was a fantastic experience. I had the opportunity to come back twice afterwards. I am always very happy to be here. Today, I'm really delighted to be with you once again. Special thanks to my friends of Cornell Institute for European Studies, Gail Host Werhaft, and Cora Batting von Wittelsbach, Jason Hecht, and the director Christopher Way. I would like to thank Laura Brown because she chose my novel last year and it was the beginning of this wonderful experience. I would like to thank Merlin and her students because Merlin still teaches my novel, Clash of Civilizations, in her course. And thank you for coming. This is very important. Thank you for coming. So in 1995, I escaped from Algeria to Italy. As a journalist at Algerian National Radio, I was a marked man. Many of my friends and colleagues had been assassinated in a civil war that would last a decade. In Italy, I found a new opportunity to live, study, write, and dream. I lived there for 18 years, first as a political refugee, then as an immigrant, and in June of 2008, I became an Italian citizen. I have had the chance to travel to many other European countries and spend a year in France and 4 months in Germany. Actually, in France, I have 5 sisters and 3 brothers, and now 7 of them live in Paris. So instead of going in Algeria, I can go directly in Paris. So I know very well France. I know very well Italy because I lived there for a long time. I know very well France too. During these years, I personally experienced the weight of immigration and the challenge of belonging to the Muslim Arab minority, especially after September 11th, 2001. This new existential, political, and cultural condition pushed me to continually ask myself, how can I reconcile my culture of origin with how can I reconcile my culture of origin with new cultures. And last year I moved to New York, to the United States, so the question is very actual, I mean. How should I behave with the majority population? Why is it crucial to get involved in and open up to the world of diversity? How can I avoid exclusion and self-exclusion? I dedicated my academic studies at the University of Rome, La Sapienza, to the Muslim immigrant minority in Italy. In my PhD thesis, I concentrated on Arab Muslim immigrants because they represent a linguistic, religious, and geographically homogeneous bloc. They were Arabs, North Africans, and Muslim Sunni. This anthropological research became the basis of four novels that I published in Arabic and Italian: Clash of Civilizations Over an Elevator in Piazza Vittorio, 2008, Divorce Islamic Style in 2010, Dispute Over a Very Italian Piglet in 2012, and the novel was published 2 years ago in English, and the last one, The Hoax of the Little Virgin in Via Ormea, published last year in Italian and will published in English in May 2016. In short, I spent almost half of my life dealing with immigration as a journalist, a scholar, an interpreter, an expert advisor, and a writer. Sincerely, I have always tried to be a good observer or a credible witness. My aim is not to condemn or judge, but rather, as Hannah Arendt insisted, to understand. In this lecture, I want to respond to this pressing question. Why is Europe failing at the issue of immigration? My idea, very original, I'm serious. My idea is that immigration, especially from the Muslim world, has become more and more a sort of bargaining chip in politics and in the media. Politicians tend to invest in propaganda against immigrants in order to win elections. Journalists, on the other hand, are interested primarily in attracting a larger audience. So, I'm a writer, so I have to use metaphors. If the immigrant is a bargaining chip, it is not hard to enlarge the metaphor by saying that politicians and journalists are merchants and citizens are simply customers. I'm going to focus on the Italian case, but based on my experience, I can argue that there is no substantial difference among European Union countries concerning immigration, especially Muslim immigration. In Italy, the Bossi-Fini Bill on Immigration was adopted in 2001 and still regulates immigration today. It has had a very negative impact on the lives of immigrants. Effectively, immigrants have become more vulnerable, but above all else, they are susceptible to blackmail applied by employers and landlords. It is an unfair law because it links residency papers to a labor contract, and it effectively denies the immigrant worker the right to be unemployed in an increasingly flexible economy. In Italy, the absolute majority of immigrants with their papers in order are former illegal immigrants who managed to come into compliance with the law. For them, the nightmare of suddenly once again becoming illegal immigrants is a constant threat. Furthermore, if one adds to the balance of power the fact that they cannot vote, this is a very important point, there is no protection for immigrants outside their own communities. And here there is a wonderful metaphor, actually story, that we have in Algeria. When someone has not a protection, someone to defend him, we say you are the orphan of the village. And the origin of the story is very interesting. So in the village, if someone wants to become a barber, he needs a practice to cut hair. So they bring him the orphans of the village to practice, you know, to practice. Because the orphans, you know, nobody cares about them. So they say, so for me, I mean, using this metaphor, I think immigrant, especially Muslim immigrant, is like an orphan. It's like a really orphan. And the worst thing, actually, that not just immigrants, even, I mean, Italian Muslim or French Muslims, Muslim French, or American Muslims too. So they live really this condition. It's like orphans of the village. What are the causes of this strategy of transforming immigrants into bargaining chips? So there are a lot of causes. Actually, here it's very hard. It's really very hard to distinguish between causes and consequences. It's very, very hard. So I'm going to examine four causes, and there are a lot of causes. So the first cause. Regarding immigration to Europe, it's clear that the extreme right has become a kind of hegemonic or winning model. In 2007, Jean-Marie Le Pen, the founder of France's Front National, accused Nicolas Sarkozy, the previous French president, of copying his political program about immigration. And he was right. He was right. For decades, issues like defending the national identity, and Sarkozy, you know, he created the Ministry of National Identity. And he tried to create a debate about this. What does mean being French? And I remember there was a blog, a big blog, created by the Ministry of National Identity, where people, you know, try to explain what they feel French. And it's incredible thing, really incredible. So, for decades, issues like defending the national identity, selective immigration, we say immigration choisie, national values, les valeurs nationales, or les valeurs de la République, so etc., were favorite cards for the extreme right. Now, they are becoming part of the conservative domain, not just in France, in Holland, in Germany, in Spain. Today, there is no substantial difference between the extreme right and the right or center right. Sometimes, even the European socialists try to imitate rightist positions and ideas. And it's very simple, because the immigrants can't vote. So the politicians want to win elections. So it's very easy to understand. There are policy initiatives and decisions against some minorities, like Roma, Gypsies, immigrants, gays, Muslims, and they are targeted for the right, I mean the extreme right, but the right as well. That makes us fear the worst. It had seems that the age of racial laws that prevailed under fascism and Nazism and passed forever, but instead the risk is always present. For a long time, it was possible to confine racist behavior to the political, cultural, and social fringe. The racist was excluded, a person not credible, rude, aggressive, and above all, a jester who evoked laughter. Today, the racist has been rehabilitated, and has become the standard of courage, the enemy of conformism, a successful politician, a trendy and fashionable journalist and an intellectual. And you know, it's not really just in Europe, everywhere, and even here in the United States or in Canada. These days, the racist is free to declare before the TV cameras, for example, that all Roma are thieves, to be thrown in jail, and Muslims, all Muslims are terrorists, to be combated, all gays are sick people who need to be treated, and so on. A few years ago, during a celebration of Lega Nord, Northern League in Italy, in Venice, the deputy mayor of Treviso, Giancarlo Gentilini, declared, quote, "Muslims should return to their countries. I want a revolution against the call centers, whose customers come to eat in the middle of the night and then pee on the walls. They should go to peace in their own mosques. The end of the quote. Fortunately, the prosecutor of Venice opened an investigation against him for incitement or racial hatred. Gentilini's response, it's really interesting. Gentilini's response to the charges was puzzling. He said, "What I have said reflects the will of my people. What I have said reflects the will of my people. It's not racism, but order, discipline, and respect for the law." The end of the quote. So we are seeing a lot of goodwill toward individual racists who are now free to use verbal and physical violence against minorities. However, more worrying is the rehabilitation of institutional racism, the beginning of a tragic movie that we have seen before. Second cause. Today in Europe, there is a huge confusion between the concept of immigrant on the one hand and a refugee on the other. While state constitutions across the European Union guarantee the rights of refugees, most countries are not respecting their own laws. This is the problem. This is a big problem. The Geneva Convention of Refugees is now 64 years old. It has been ratified by 145 countries, including all European countries. It is, however, often violated with rules and practices such as the rejection of refugees, which deprives people of the right to present requests for asylum. It is no state secret that there are hidden waiting rooms in the airports of European capitals. And I had personally a bad experience in Rome airport. It is no state secret that there are hidden waiting rooms in the airports of European capitals, where those requesting asylum are placed in the quarantine while they wait to send back, often to countries they have fled, and thus endangering their lives. Violations, unfortunately, do not only concern this international convention, but also the European Union's various constitutions. Article 10 of the Italian Constitution, for example, states that, quote, "A foreigner prevented in his own country from exercising the democratic freedoms guaranteed by the Italian Constitution has the right to asylum in the territories of the Republic in compliance with conditions established by law. The deportation of the Republic, deportation of foreigners accused of political crimes is forbidden. The end of the article. There is therefore, in theory, a basic juridical principle that allows all foreigners to present a request for political asylum in Italy. In practice, instead, there are open violations. In 2009, Italy has signed a treaty with Libya, which a country that has not signed the Geneva Convention, establishing that foreigners will be rejected at sea and on Italian territory. This policy prevents the identification of those who have a right to some form of protection. One must bear in mind that in 2008, of the 75% of illegal immigrants who arrived in Italy by sea, many Somalis and Eritreans, and were able to present a request for asylum, almost half were guaranteed the right to some form of protection, say a humanitarian asylum. And a humanitarian asylum actually is an invention. Doesn't exist in Geneva Convention. Faced with this serious violation of human rights, we systematically observe media strategies adopted by politicians and journalists alike, designed to question the very existence of refugees requesting asylum. The idea of economic refugees has now become fashionable, but they can't, you know, they can't say now with the Syrians that they are, you know, economic refugees. But they said this with, you know, with the Somalis and Eritreans and other populations. But now with the Syrians, it's very clear, they are refugees, not immigrants, and they have a right. And I am so happy because just a few days ago, Jürgen Habermas, the previous messenger lecturer, said the same thing, that the refugees have the right to present requests. Just a request, to present a request. But I think they have all conditions, because the situation in Syria is very clear. It's very, very clear. So the idea of economic refugees has now become fashionable. During a visit to Lampedusa in the south of Italy in 2011, the future French presidential candidate Marine Le Pen, who has replaced his father Jean-Marie as the leader of the Front National, said, "I have seen the beginning of what will become a wave in Europe is unable to build a dam to stop this flow. A demographic bomb from North Africa countries will blow up in its face. Most of these people are what I call economic refugees, people fleeing very difficult living conditions. If Italy were to host all the economic refugees that turn up at its borders, the country would have to host half the world's population." The end of the quote. Marine Le Pen also said, "Most of those who arrived in Lampedusa are Tunisian. We were in 2011, the beginning of Arab Spring in Tunisia. Ben Ali's regime, the previous president, Ben Ali's regime has fallen, and only his relatives should be considered political refugees." So they gave support to the dictators for decades, because Tunisia, I remember very well, Tunisia for many European politicians was a model of democracy. So they gave protection to the dictators, and then they want to give asylum to their relatives. So according to Le Pen, asylum, this is a quote, according to Le Pen, asylum should only be guaranteed to dictators and their families. This makes a joke of all treaties on refugees and asylum seekers. I believe this is very important, and I'm so proud, very so proud of me, because I said these words in the Italian parliament. I was invited in Italian parliament twice, the first as an expert advisor, and the second to present my novel dispute over a very Italian piglet. And they said these words, this sentence. I said, what is it? I believe the law should be applied even when we consider it unfair. This was that great lesson taught by Socrates, who refused to escape from prison and save his life so as not to break the law on the basis of which he has been sentenced to death. International constitutions and conventions must be respected without subterfuge. Every foreigner arriving in Europe must be permitted to present a request for asylum. Because it was my case in 1995, fortunately I had the opportunity to change, the chance to present a request. And they gave me the right to live in Italy. So every foreigner arriving in Europe must be permitted to present a request for asylum. This is a constitutional right. Here we are dealing with the respect of the Constitution. The commission appointed to examine the requests will then establish whether a person has the right or not to refugee status and protection. In Italy, in 1995, I met the commission. They asked me questions and answered. So I had this possibility. For as long as such a law exists, there is no choice but to apply it until such time as the law is changed or repealed. This is very important. This is very important, not just for Italy, for all European countries. All European countries. They have in their constitution this right. They have to guarantee. They have to respect their constitution. The alternative is to cancel, to delete these articles. Third cause. I'm getting a little bit nervous when I talk about this, because it's my story. Third cause. There is no substantial difference between the elite and the masses. This is a very important idea. So really, this is a very important idea, and this is the result of my really long experience as a writer, as a journalist, as an observer. There is no substantial difference between the elite and the masses. Everywhere. Because in the past, the elite, we have the opportunity to distinguish elite and masses. Now there is a big confusion. There is a really big confusion. I mean, you can go in the bar. In Italy we have bars. You go to take a cappuccino, espresso, and there are a lot of people. They talk about soccer, certainly, politics. Women, if there are a lot of men, so they talk about women, and stereotypes, prejudices, etc. This is in the bar, but if you watch the TV, there are talk shows and debates. This is the same. They are the same issues, the same level, the same level. So the bar and even in the parliaments sometimes. So there is, it's very hard to distinguish elite, the elite and the masses. So the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001 marked a profound epistemological breakdown. Because, you know, today, when we talk about immigration in Europe, we are talking about immigration, Muslim immigrants. This is the problem. This is the problem. So the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001 marked a profound epistemological breakdown. In fact, there was a negative discontinuity within the framework of knowledge of Islam in the West. Faced with the need to identify and know the new enemy, the media very quickly searched for experts on Islam. I was in Italy in 2001, and I was a journalist at the time. The media very quickly searched for experts of Islam. And actually, I lost a big, big opportunity to become very famous, really very famous in 2001. It was enough to go in TV to say all Muslims are terrorists. Islam is negative, etc., etc. It was really big, and there I know a lot of people. I know a lot of journalists. They create their career about doing this. Fortunately, it wasn't my case. What was the result? The media put forward a series of experts who spoke neither Arabic or at least one of the Muslim words, language, and who lacked in-depth knowledge of Muslim country. I wonder, it is possible to be an expert on America or Germany without speaking English or knowing the United States or without speaking German and knowing Germany? This is impossible. This is impossible. I have never met, you know, expert of America, doesn't speak English, and doesn't know, American society, American history, etc. Even with, as well as with German, Germanophony, German, what shall we say?
German speakers?
Yeah, German scholars, I mean. Yeah. Or expert in German culture. So the show goes on. There was a really show, and we are seeing shows actually, not debates about Islam and Muslim immigrants. So we continue to see on TV improvised experts with no knowledge of languages spoken in the Muslim world, especially Arabic, and who have never attended courses on Islam. So they do, however, publish books with great publishing houses and are invited to speak on television as experts of Islamic subjects. One must bear in mind that explaining Islam to non-Muslims was in the past entrusted to Orientalists. Western scholars who spoke at least one of the Muslim words languages. And one must acknowledge that they brought to light manuscripts of Arab literature and philosophy as 1001 Nights and Al-Mukaddima, the introduction, a masterpiece of modern historiography, written by Ibn Khaldun, died in 1406. During the 60s and the 70s, following the independence of many Arab Muslim countries, a number of Arab scholars, such Anwar Abdel Malik, Egyptian, and Edward Said, accused Orientalists of having placed their linguistic and anthropological knowledge at the service of the colonial powers. It did not question their linguistic and cultural competence, but only on ethical grounds. They use the made of their expertise. I remember that during a talk show on Italian TV, the famous Italian politician Daniela Santanché, she is very famous politician, described the Prophet Muhammad as a pedophile. She described a Prophet Muhammad as a pedophile because he married Aisha when she was a minor. This was not her first provocation, and sadly, it will not be the last one. To offend Muslim immigrants and a billion of or more Muslims is irrelevant. What matters is never being forgotten by the media. This is the trick. This is the trick. Santanché expressed an extremely serious opinion since it addresses a mainly historical event that the Prophet Muhammad lived 14 centuries ago, without putting it into context. Because if you don't have knowledge, if you don't know language, if you don't speak language, you can't find the context. There is no question that pedophilia is the worst of crimes because it harms innocent children. As far as the Prophet Muhammad is concerned, however, one must address the issue of early marriages and try to understand the system of alliances in traditional societies. This is an interesting topic about, you know, the Prophet and his wives. I need much time to discuss about this. I would like just to say that Prophet Muhammad had 9 wives. At the time, 30 or 40 years ago, virginity was a very important value. Prophet Muhammad had 9 wives. Just Aisha was virgin. The first wife, Khadija, was a very important woman. She was the first believer of Islam. The first believer in Islam was a woman, his wife, Khadija. Khadija was a widow. And she was 40 years old when the Prophet married her. And the Prophet was 25. So we have to understand history and the context. So the Prophet had these wives in order to establish the relationships with different people. He married even with Maria. Maria was Copt, a Christian, in order to reinforce his relation with other populations. So as far as the Prophet Muhammad is concerned, however, one must address the issue of early marriages and try to understand the system of alliances in traditional societies. This phenomenon was a widespread custom, not only in the Muslim world, but also many other contexts. Marie Antoinette, the Napoleon's wife, was minor, when she married Napoleon. So Napoleon was a pedophile, okay, according to Daniela Santanché. My mother was married in 1953 when she was 15 years old. But also, my mother was married in 1953 when she was 15 years old, and thus a minor. Should I consider my father a pedophile? This is a very important question for me. In recent years, I have often seen Daniela Santanché speaking on TV mainly about gossip. And you can check, if you want to go to YouTube, you can find all videos about her. Daniela Santanché. about gossip. I have heard her hold forth in favor of plastic surgery. And parliamentarians right to wear high heels in the hall of the parliament. So in spite of all this, she has managed to gain a reputation as an expert of Islamic matters. Now she discusses the veil, mosques, and even the holy war. Effectively, she continues to be accepted as a do-it-yourself expert in the Middle East, although lacking the most elementary information needed to form intelligent opinions concerning religion as complex as Islam. There are real, serious, and competent experts in Italy and in Europe, even here in the United States, but they are never invited to appear on talk shows because they do not have the physique du rôle needed for entertaining TV audiences. True leaders, have visions, projects for the future. They are not just playing it by ear. In Italian, we say navigare a vista. Because elite is leadership. But now we are seeing not leaders, but followers. Intellectuals, journalists, politicians follow the masses, what people say in the bars, in the streets. And this is a huge problem. It's really a huge, huge problem. So in my novel, Clash of Civilizations Over an Elevator in Piazza Vittorio, the character of Benedetta Esposito, the concierge, Neapolitan concierge, acts like a politician or journalist. Really, there is no distinction between my Neapolitan concierge and a lot of politicians and a lot of intellectuals and a lot of journalists. So Benedetta says, this is a passage, I chose this passage because when I gave my novel before publishing it, I gave it to my friend, one of my friends. When he read the novel, he said to me, "Your character, Benedetta Esposito, is not credible." I asked him, "Well, why?" He said to me, "She seems sociologist. She seems journalist." And they say, "Yes. This is true, because I had a lot of experiences with a lot of concierges in Rome. I talked with them, and I found these ideas. This is truth. I mean, from the reality. I am sure," Benedetta says, "I am sure the murderer of Lorenzo Manfredini is one of the immigrants. The government should hurry up and do something. Soon, they will be throwing us out of our own country. All you have to do is take a walk in the afternoon in the gardens, if in Piazza Vittorio, to see that the majority of the people are foreigners. Some come from Morocco, some from Romania, China, India, Senegal, Poland, Albania. Living with them is impossible. They have religions, habits, and traditions different from ours. In their countries, they live outside on or in tents. They eat with their hands. They travel on donkeys and camels and treat women like slaves. I'm not a racist, but that's the truth. Even the famous journalist Bruno Vespa on TV says so. Then why do they come to Italy? I don't know. We are full up with unemployed." And here, just parentheses, in Europe, I mean, against immigrants in general, they use this, you know, this card that immigrants take out jobs for the, you know, the natives. And this is not true. Absolutely. And there is a wonderful book in Italian written by a friend of mine, a journalist in Repubblica, one of the most important newspapers in Italy. His name is Riccardo Staliano. He wrote a book about immigrants and jobs. And he traveled around Italy in different cities, and in each city he chose one job. And the result, the conclusion, that immigrants are doing jobs that Italians refuse to do. And they are very, very hard works. Very, 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 very hard works. So this is not true. It's just propaganda. So my son Gennaro doesn't have a job. If it weren't for his wife Marina, who's a seamstress, and help from me, he would have ended up a beggar outside the church of San Domenico Maggiore in Naples. If there is no work for the people of this country, how is it that we welcome all the disparate types? Every week we see boats loaded with illegal immigrants on the TV news. They bring contagious disease like plague and malaria. Emilio Fede is another Italian journalist. Always says so, but no one listens to him. The last cause, the fourth cause. I mean the last cause of this strategy of transforming immigrant in bargaining chip. This is the fourth cause. And I mean, it's very hard, really. I told you, it's very hard to distinguish causes and between causes and causes. So here, the fourth is cause and consequence at the same time. So the fourth cause is about obstructing a European Islam, and actually this is my main idea in my thesis. I believe that reforming Islam today in Muslim worlds is, I don't like impossible word. The word impossible, I don't like it. I don't like impossible because I'm a big dreamer, and if you are a dreamer, you have to delete word impossible. I met yesterday a lot of students, and I talked with them about my dream for becoming a writer. So I canceled the word impossible. So I can use, it's very hard. So it's very hard to reform Islam today in Muslim worlds. It's very hard. Because because Islam is really in very delicate position. We have in the middle, Islam is in the middle. So in one hand we have dictators, and in other side we have fundamentalists. And actually, dictators and fundamentalists play in the same team. They play in the same team. So if we want to reform Islam, we need freedom. And there is no freedom with dictatorships, with dictators and with fundamentalists. So the only possibility, the only opportunity to reform Islam is reforming Islam by outside. This is my this is the result of my research and my experience. So European Islam and American Islam is really very important chance to reform Islam. Because here in America, in Europe, a lot of Muslims feel free to leave Islam more than in their countries. So does a European version of Islam exist? The most effective way to find an answer is to check in within what the majority of Muslim immigrants living in Europe think. Do they feel like an active minority? Or do they prefer to retreat to ethnic ghettos, proposing a version of Islam similar to that of their countries of origin? Already in deep crisis because of religious fundamentalism and authoritarian of their regimes. And today Egypt is an incredible example. It's a really incredible example. So fundamentalists in one hand and militars, dictators in the other hand. Because I don't believe militars can become Democrats. It's impossible. It's impossible. How do they try Muslim immigrants to solve, or Muslim in Europe? Because there are a lot of citizens. There are a lot of Muslim citizens like me in America. There are a lot of Muslim. I mean, there are citizens, American citizens. But one candidate, I don't remember his name, maybe Carson, said that American Muslim can't become a president. And this is against Constitution, American Constitution. This is the problem. This is the big problem, not just against immigrants. This is against constitutions. And we have to be very, very careful. We have to be very, very careful. So with how do they try to solve the problems of today? With answers imported from their countries of origin or with new solutions. And there are a lot of Muslim immigrants in Italy, in the United States. Instead of finding new solutions for their problems, they tried to import from their countries of origin solutions. Knowing that Islam is in crisis. Islam in Muslim world is in crisis. Terrorism, violence is just a result. It's a result of education, for example. You have to see what books they teach to the children, I mean. So we have a really deep crisis. So instead of finding new solutions, so they try to import old solutions from their countries of origin. And it's crazy. This is crazy, really crazy. And I have a lot of positions actually about Muslim. I am Muslim, but I am very critical with a lot of practices. For example, a niqab. I'm not talking with the veil, I'm talking with a niqab. Niqab is not, so in Islam we have five pilasters of Islam. Five, not six. The first is, it's just I'm trying to give you basic information. So the five pilasters of Islam, the declaration of faith, so you declare that there is just one God and the Prophet is his last messenger, not the only messenger, the last, because there are the lists. Christ, Moses, Abraham, etc. They are list. And the Prophet is the last. Is the last messenger. This is the first. The second condition to be a Muslim, to be considered Muslim, is to is pray. Pray five times a day. The third is called zakat. To give 10% of your income, just 10% in your income in charity. This is wonderful. I mean, think. The third is very important. The fourth is fast, Ramadan. 1 month a year you have to fast to do a Ramadan. The last one is not really an obligation. The last one is to go to Mecca. So if you have a good health, because if you are ill, you cannot go to Mecca. The first condition, having good health and having money. So you can't go to the bank or someone to have, you know, to borrow money, and they're going to go in the, you have to go to Mecca with your own money. And the fifth pilaster is incredible, is wonderful. Because in the past, now we have, you know, flights, and you know, it's very easy to fly. But in the past, if a Muslim in North Africa wants to go to Mecca, he had to travel more than 2 months to go there. And it was incredible, incredible trip. Because traveling, there was an opportunity to meet people, to discover new cultures. And they go to Mecca and they met people there. And it was an incredible experience, even today. Mecca is, I mean, going to Mecca is incredible. It's incredible. So five pilasters. Big niqab. I mean this form of veil doesn't exist in Islam. Doesn't exist. There is no mention in Quran or in interpretation. It's just an interpretation. So I have five sisters. Four of them doesn't wear a veil. Just one. And they are free. Veil, I mean, not niqab and not burqa. So this is just an example how Muslim immigrants should deal with the new reality. I mean, veil or niqab is not a priority. It's not priority here in America or in Europe. The priority is education, of children. This is a very important priority. So the result of my research confirms that Islamic identity in Europe is very strong and demands visibility. To continue considering Islam as a problem of public order, as it is the case in Europe, has serious consequences. I think that the idea of an Islamization of Europe or Islamization of America is unrealistic. Is just propaganda. It's just propaganda and serves only to fuel Islamophobia. To Europeanize and Americanize Islam, however, is possible, because the Muslim religion is a culture. And like any culture, it is subject to change and can adapt itself to new contexts. And anthropologists use the concept of acculturation to explain the permeability of cultures. When two cultures meet, they can undergo a reciprocal influence. They give up the ineffective old elements and they acquire new, more functional ones. The history of Islam is a demonstration of this. The Muslim expansion throughout the centuries has given rise to an Islam that varies greatly from one context to another. There is an Indonesian Islam, and a Chinese one, a Pakistani, Turkish, Iranian, Bosnian, Somali, Senegalese, Egyptian, Moroccan, Saudi Arabian Islam, and so on. Saudi Arabian Islam is the worst. It's really the worst. The worst. And they tried for many years to, I'm sorry if they are Saudi here, is not, you know, their problem, but for many years they export this model in different places in the world. And now, unfortunately, they have trouble in their country. And we have to remember, this is very important to remember, that, you know, suicide attacks in New York, so there were 19, 16 were from Saudi Arabia. 16. And they were educated people. This is the truth. This is the truth. And I always said to my Muslim friends, we have to have courage. We have to have courage to face these problems. And I did this, and I am doing this, because we don't have another alternative. In reality, Muslim immigrants in Europe are reforming Islam by fortifying individual freedom. As we know, religion is a very powerful instrument of social control. Islam is no exception. To say this in the words of French philosopher Michel Foucault, societies use religion to monitor the behavior of individuals and to punish the transgressors. The penalty can be steeper than prison because it has to do with disgrace, the loss of extreme or exclusion from the community. Here an example from my doctoral dissertation. I did this thesis in Italy about a Muslim minority in Italy. Actually, the thesis is middle anthropology and middle literature. Middle literature, because I use the stories. I talked with a lot of Muslim immigrants, and I did an editing. Because here it's very important, the self-representation. In my thesis, I try to avoid the role of an expert. I mean, talk in place of others. So I gave I gave voice to the Muslim immigrants, and I discovered wonderful things. Because Muslim immigrants know very well their reality, their lives, much better than the experts. They know their reality. So here an example for my doctoral dissertation, and this thesis actually is the base of my novel, Divorce Islamic Style, is based on my dissertation. A 41-year-old Egyptian living in Milan, whom I interviewed, said, living far away from the country of origin, and moreover in a non-Muslim country, is a big challenge. It is not easy to keep faith, pray, or observe Ramadan. Here, in Italy, you are controlled by no one, only by God. If you are in Egypt, you are obliged to do Ramadan, if only out of respect for your family. In Italy, however, you are free to fast or eat. The end of the quote. So far from the country of origin, group control, state, family, or community over the individual tends to disappear. So fasting, for example, becomes a strictly a private, not public matter, an individual, not collective choice, is more spiritual than political and social. And in Islam, actually, you know the explanation of the five prayers a day, the explanation that Muslim has a direct relationship with God. So if Muslim wants to communicate something to God, he doesn't need a mediation to go to someone and ask, I would like to ask God, can you help me? So you have five prayers a day, and you can communicate with God, because praying is communicating with God. It's direct contacts. What the fundamentalists do is to play the role of mediator. So the fundamentalist comes and say, okay, would you become a good Muslim? Would you communicate with God? I'm here. I'm a mediator. This is the role of the fundamentalists. And I don't accept this mediation. And this is my critique against fundamentalists. So individual freedom is fundamental for the emancipation of women. This is a very important point. Very important point. Muslim immigration is a great opportunity to make the tides of change for more rapid. And I'm seeing my sisters. There is a huge difference between my sisters in Algeria and my sisters in France. In France, they are more free. They don't need authorization to go to work or to go to see their friends. So a young Algerian woman who lives in Turin, I interviewed her, said, this is very interesting, since I have been in Italy, I have opened my eyes. I do not like a social control, especially against women. Unlike my sisters who remained in Algeria, I do not accept certain impositions. The end of the quote. The reform of Islam passes through the reconciliation with some great achievements of modernity, such as individual freedom and the protection of private life. It is much better to leave this religion in a context where the individual is free to choose instead of in the country of origin, which can be characterized by totalitarian regimes and fundamentalists determined to prevent change. And the result, we can see the situation today in Muslim worlds. Dictatorships and fundamentalists, and they play in the same team. They are only one team. They are playing against a change. Conclusion. Is Europe becoming a bad model of immigration in the world? I mean, not just in Europe, here in North America, in United States and Canada. The answer, unfortunately, is yes. The European model, I have this chance. I lived in Europe for almost 20 years, and I moved to United States last year, and I'm seeing a lot of similarities. A lot of similarities. So 2 weeks ago, I don't want to talk about American situation. You know very well, I mean, the issues about politics and Islam, immigration, etc. So this is 2 weeks ago, I went to Montreal and Quebec to give some talks. This was during the last days of national political campaign. I was really, really surprised to see that immigration, especially the Muslim immigration, was a central issue. I have newspapers. I brought newspapers in the first page. I mean, instead of talking, I saw the campaign, the debate between the candidates. Instead of talking about the banks, for example, they are, you know, doing a lot of disasters. Banks, they talk about Islam and the niqab and so the candidates, the Canadian candidates, spent much time explaining their position on Zunia Ishaq. Zunia Ishaq is the woman of Pakistani origin. I mean, she is Canadian, she is a citizen, and she decided to wear niqab. And in Canada, there is a huge bit debate about her. One woman is in the center of the debate. This is crazy. This is crazy. So, really last conclusion, yesterday I gave this wonderful talk and I met a lot of students. And I use the metaphor of soccer. I love soccer. And for me, soccer is a very nice metaphor. It's like, you know, it's like life. We have the beginning and we have the end. In soccer, we have 90 minutes. We have the beginning and we have the end. And the best thing in soccer, that the game is over until the end. And we have wonderful games. I remember many years ago, I think 1999, in final Champions League, between Bayern and Manchester United. So Bayern was winning the game, and it was the last minute, really last minute. And Manchester United made the goal. And there's one and one. And then after 1 minute, and Manchester United made another goal, second goal, and won. It's incredible example. It's example about life. You have chance to change your life, to dream before the end. The game is over. So my title, why is Europe failing at the issue of immigration, is very optimistic. It's very optimistic because I believe that the game is not over. It's not over. If we want to win the game, we have to change the strategy. We have to change the way of playing, because in this way you are losing. So the game is not over, and we have the chance to change it. And this is my hope. Thank you so much. Yeah, if someone has questions or comments or... This is very nice question. I mean, supporting new ideas is very important. I mean, especially reforming Islam. So we have to give a voice, give a possibility to these people to be more effective in society, and to be very careful about constitutions. You have to be very, very careful with constitutions. If there is an inequality between citizens, and there is no differences between Muslims and Christians and Jews, we have to respect. We have to respect Muslim Americans, and they are citizens, and they have the right to be Muslims, and the same thing in Europe. So the problem is against, they aren't against the Muslim immigrants or immigrant or refugees. They are against constitutions. And this is very dangerous issue. Marlene? Right.
Could you talk a little bit about the way that about your dream to reflect on Muslim immigration and right. About how you see your strategy going forward?
Thank you, Marlene, for this question. Because yesterday I used the metaphor of soccer, and I said that having a dream is like playing a game. You have to have a good team to realize your dream. And in soccer, we have 11 players. So I choose 11 ideas, players. And one of these players are having planning, having strategy, because it's not enough to be a dreamer. We have to have a plan, strategy to realize your dream. Actually, I published this novel, Divorce Islamic Style. It is a very, very important novel. It's about Muslim immigration, and it's about Islam in Europe. And I was very sincere. The novel is very, very, serious. I tried to describe the reality, and I was critical with some practices about Muslim. For example, using media. In the novel, I narrated the story of those immigrants instead of following Italian TV, local TVs, so they follow Al Jazeera. So they know more what is happening in Iraq and in Afghanistan, in the world, than the city where they live. And this is crazy. So you have to know the reality where you live, not the country of origin. This is a critic. So I wrote this novel, and I think it's very important to as strategy to change the reality. And I wrote the novel both in Arabic and Italian. And the novel was published in Lebanon and in Algeria. So this is very important to encourage this European Islam. So this is my, and I gave a lot of talks, and I was in the Italian parliament, I met politicians, so I tried to be effective.
Is there any means within the Geneva Convention, if countries are, who have signed that, are not following what they're supposed to be doing, is there any means within the way it's worded for them to be held accountable for that? Is there any practical way that a country can be held accountable for not?
I mean, this is, thank you so much. The problem here is, the elite, intellectuals, leaders. I mean, a leader has a vision about the future. Now we don't have leaders but followers, and we had this in Italy with Berlusconi. Berlusconi certainly is one of the most important entrepreneur merchant. He was an incredible merchant. And he tried to apply his strategy in commerce, in politics. You know, every day Berlusconi, of course he had I think even now he is in a, I mean he is not in the government, but even now, before taking a position, sondaggi, spoil. Paul. So they pay the agencies to make polls. And if the majority of people say, today I'm against Muslims, Berlusconi is going to declare that he is against the Muslim. And this is a model. Berlusconi became a model in France. Sarkozy copied Berlusconi. And here in the United States, there is one candidate, and he is copying Berlusconi. And he said, Berlusconi is my model. You can't be leader if you follow the masses. Masses, masses are emotions, not rationality. Masses are fear, emotions, etc. So we need leaders. And about Geneva Convention, we need leaders. Leaders not just in politics. Leaders in media. Intellectuals, professors, and they have to have courage to say things against masses. I'm not against masses, but I'm against some ideas of them because based on fear and emotions and etc. So we need leaders, not followers. And today we don't have leaders. I have followers in politics, in media, in intellectuals. This is a huge problem, huge problem.
Well, I think we'll stop there. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming.